Good morning. I'm sure a lot of you didn't really know what to expect this morning. The last couple weeks here have been a little bit unpredictable with snow and sickness. I know last week Jim was scheduled to preach and woke up early that morning and his throat wasn't doing too well. I actually lost my voice Wednesday night, and last night it was probably the worst it was. And as John was saying, I was up at Malagash, and if you've ever been to camp before, you know that camp isn't the best place if you want to get your voice back. So last night I didn't have much of a voice, and some of the other staff were joking that I might have to come up here and type what I'm going to say into Google Translate and let Siri do the job for me. But as you can tell, my voice is probably about 80, 85% back. You might hear a few voice cracks every now and then. Could be from nervousness. It might just be from not having a voice. But yeah, it's good to be here. This is my church family. This is my home. I'd be lying if I said I wasn't nervous. But yeah, being at Malagash this weekend, I love how it puts things into perspective. There's times over the last week or so where I would get quite nervous just thinking and studying and pondering about what God might want me to share. But then you get to a place like Malagash and you don't get any sleep. And yeah, things are crazy, but God just does stuff. And yeah, it just, like, I mean, I've been there what feels like for so long, but I always get taken aback with what I see God doing there. And then just on the drive back this morning, thinking that God has done so much, and so much of it that, like, I really didn't have any part in. And then I look at my notes and what I think, like, what are these, you know, what are my 5 points? Like, what if I mess those up, what does it really matter? So anyways, with that, I don't know if you heard, but this is actually maybe my fourth time scheduled to speak, but because of the magnitude of snowstorms and other stuff we've had, we've kept having to postpone. So I actually had a sermon written out, one that I had prepared for school, and I had spoke at school, and I took all the negative feedback and I tried to fix it up a bit. So I had that prepared, and I said, well, I'll just try to use the feedback that I was given, and I'll try to turn it from a B into an A for church on Sunday. But yeah, a couple of weeks ago, I was trying to refresh my mind, so I was looking through the notes, and spoiler alert, if I ever do preach it, it was a sermon on judgment. I was looking at, it was John chapter 8 or 10, I forget. But anyways, the sermon was on judgment. So I think it was a decent sermon. It had a good message. And it was a pretty safe sermon. The application obviously was, don't judge others, let God be judge. So there you have it. That's the sermon that I'm not going to preach. But yeah, as I was looking through the notes a couple of weeks ago, I said, okay, I have this thing on paper. I have this idea in my mind. So now as I go out for the day, I'm going to keep this sermon in my mind and I'm going to see how it plays out in my life. So I got in my car and I drove off to school or wherever it was I was going, and I just kept the sermon in the back of my mind. And I get in my car and I get on the highway towards the valley, and the first thought that goes through my mind is, look how bad of a driver they are. Like, what are they wearing? Do they know what the temperature is? And I started to notice this thought pattern of what I would call judgmental thoughts. And I said, well, if I'm going to preach on judgment, maybe I should let this message sink into my own heart a little bit more first. So anyways, I'd intended to bring up those papers just so I could show you that I'm not being extra spiritual and making that up, but I was at Malagash and I left them at home and I wasn't about to go get them this morning. But anyways, that's the sermon that I'm not going to preach. This week's sermon, I wrote maybe over the last few weeks, I've been chipping away at it, and I think it's the closer it came to Sunday, the more controversial I realized that it is. At first, I thought maybe it might be something nice and applicable for everyone, but yeah, I hope that, well, I shouldn't say I hope that it doesn't rub any feathers the wrong way, but I hope that yeah, no one gets upset in an unhealthy way. I'll say that. But anyways, before I get myself in any trouble, let me pray, and then I'll read the passage that we're going to look through. So, Father, yeah, I thank you for this opportunity. I thank you for this church family, the blessing that they've been to me and to so many others, and the testimonies that we've heard and that we've been a part of. I pray, God, that, yeah, this message that you've given me, that it would, yeah, that your words, your ideas, your thoughts would come through, and that we would be open to what you have, even if it's nothing that's on my three pages of notes. So yeah, God, I pray for each one here. As John said, I pray that ultimately what this would do would cause us to love one another more deeply and to love you more deeply and to be witnesses to Fall River and to the ends of the earth. Yeah, I pray that all in the name of Jesus. Amen. So if you have your Bibles, which I actually don't, I have my phone Bible, but if you have a Bible or a phone Bible, we're going to be looking at Daniel chapter 3. You probably could have guessed that by hearing about Shadrach. So Daniel chapter 3, and we'll be reading from verse 10 up to verse 18. Your Majesty has issued a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music must fall down and worship the image of gold, and that whoever does not fall down and worship will be thrown into a blazing furnace. But there are some Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who pay no attention to you, Your Majesty. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold that you have set up. Furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king, and Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold that I have set up? Now, when you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, if you are ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what god will be able to rescue you from my hand?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to him, "King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold that you have set up." So in this passage, just a little bit of background information. So Daniel and his friends that we read about, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they were taken as exiles from the land of Israel. And they were told by Nebuchadnezzar, this King Nebuchadnezzar that we read about, that they were ordered to worship other gods and they were to bow down to the statue. But ultimately what we see in verses 17 and 18 here is that they end up refusing to bow down to the statue, and they stand up for their faith. They stand up for their God. So then the application of this is, stand up for your faith and be willing to die for it. The end. Or is there a little more? Because what I learned in one of my classes is that maybe there's actually a little more going on here. And well, yes, I do think that is an application that really fires me up. There is more, I think, that we can learn from this story. So flashback a few weeks ago to New Year's. I didn't really have any plans, but I had a friend who was also connected with Malagash, and he wanted to have a fun New Year's time. So he asked me to get together and we should do something. So I said, sure, I don't really care what we do. So he came over and we pondered a few ideas of how we could spend New Year's. And we ended up finding a party, like a Christian kind of 15 to 20 people, no alcohol kind of party. I know I said I wouldn't speak about judgment, but I just had to throw that in there, so. So we found this, yeah, this, I'll just call it event that we were going to go to. So we drove there. It was cold, kind of snowy New Year's Eve night, and we find the house. I park my car by the curb, turn it off, and we're about to go in, and we look at the house, and we see like a multitude of people going into this house, and we look and we see what they're carrying, and it didn't look like it was going to be the kind of gathering that we thought it might be. So my friend looked at me and said, I don't know if this is the kind of thing I had in mind. I don't really know if I want to go in here. So I said, okay, I understand that. I feel a little uneasy about it too. So I said, well, what are we going to do then? I mean, it's 10 o'clock at night. Like, I don't, I want to get to bed at a decent hour. I'm getting old now. So we sat in my car for probably about 10 minutes just trying to decide, what, you know, it's New Year's. We probably shouldn't just go to bed before midnight. That wouldn't be very fun. So we just pondered some ideas, and eventually we talked to a friend who lived out in DeBert, Nova Scotia, which if you know where DeBert is, it's past Truro, so it's about more than an hour away from the city. So my initial reaction was, no, absolutely, like, I don't want to drive there in the snow at 10 p.m. On a cold December night. But anyways, he convinced me, so there we went, and we drove off to DeBert to hang out with my friend, our other friend, his girlfriend, and his parents, which is maybe not exactly what I had in mind for a New Year's Eve party, but again, I didn't care that much, and yeah, who knows, maybe it could be a good time. So we went there, and basically what he said is, okay, since we're not doing what we intended to do, let's try to make this one of the best New Year's ever. Let's try to make the most fun out of it as we can. So I didn't know what that meant, but I said, sure, whatever you want to do, we'll do it, as long as it's safe and it's healthy, yada, yada. So we ended up, I think we played Nintendo Wii that night, which it was fun. But what I didn't realize was the next morning, I said, okay, guys, I would like to head back to this city by 11 a.m. because I have a lot of work to do, a lot of homework. But before I could kind of put my foot down with that, our other friend's girlfriend was there, and she said, oh, I'm going to yoga in the morning. You guys should join me at yoga. I think she was joking, and I definitely thought she was joking, but the other two guys thought that was a great idea. And I said, well, yoga is not exactly what I had in mind for a New Year's celebration. But they thought that would be great because I'm sure if you see me try to bend over or do any sort of agile movements, you would know that yoga might not be my most natural ability. But I was reluctant. Also, if you know me, I'm a quite competitive person, so I didn't want to go to yoga and, you know, be one of the worst there. But that's actually not what was kind of my biggest, like, turnoff to going. So I didn't necessarily grow up in, like, a Christian or, like, a weekly church-attending family. I kind of entered into this tradition that was, I don't know how to explain it, but it's like the tradition was like you stay away from anything that is not like 100% godly. And I don't know if you know anything about yoga, but it's changed. It's a different thing today, but it's a practice that came out of the Buddhist religion. And although it's nothing like that today, that's kind of where it has its roots. So I was told, kind of when I became a Christian, that you stay away from that kind of stuff. So that was kind of my biggest red flag. That, and then also not being able to touch my toes. But I've worked on my flexibility since then. I could probably do it now. But anyways, ultimately I decided that I would give it a go. And so we went. All the guys were filming me and laughing at me, but it was a good time. And yeah, nothing happened. They didn't ask me to bow down to any statues. They didn't ask me to worship any other gods, but yeah, and I went there. It was fun. Would I do it again? Probably not, at least not if I had the choice. But yeah, I haven't thought about it much since then, to be honest. And so, thinking back to the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and their refusal to bow down to the statue, how is it that I came to this conclusion to participate in something that has these Buddhist kind of roots, something that you could kind of look at and say, oh, that's not a Christian practice? How did I come to this conclusion that would be an okay thing for me to do, knowing that the choice that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego made was so, like, they put their foot down and they refused to participate in this bowing down to the statue. So a little more background in this story. So King Nebuchadnezzar, he's kind of a visionary person. So that kind of means he was a person who saw, is it the forest? Yeah, he saw the forest for the trees. He didn't see the trees for the forest. And I'm kind of like that, I'm sure. I know quite a few other people in here are like that. So he was a visionary. And so he had this vision of creating this new city, this new empire that would be called Babylon. And so to create this new empire, he wanted to gather people with a certain intellectual and physical capability so that he could build like this great empire. And so Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego met these requirements, and they thought that they would be the perfect fit for building his empire. So one day, out of the blue, without them expecting it, he came and he took them out of Israel and he brought them into this new land where he wanted to establish his empire. Daniel and his friends had no intention of leaving. They were quite, at least I think they were quite happy, or they were quite content, and they knew what they were doing in Israel. But then all of a sudden, they were taken away to a foreign land and a new culture. During this time, Daniel and his friends, they had their names changed, and they were taught Babylonian language and culture. So when we read this story for the first 10, 12 chapters or whatever, we often jump to the story that I read. We often look to the story of where they stand up for their faith, where they don't bow down to the statue. But they made a lot of other choices along the way that maybe we wouldn't consider as radical, but I think if we take a closer look at it, we can see exactly like the dynamics that are taking place here. So if you want to read along, I'm gonna go through a few verses. Feel free, but I'll just start reading them off. So if we look in Daniel chapter 1, verse 4, it says, "He, Nebuchadnezzar, was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians." Babylonian education was polytheistic, meaning that it It's education involved learning about many different gods. It was full of idols, magic, and other gods. So, yeah, their education didn't necessarily line up with maybe the education that they would have received in Israel. Chapter 1, verse 17 says, "And to these four young men God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning." So that's interesting. So God actually gave them understanding of other gods, other religious beliefs. So the God of Israel gave that knowledge to them. Chapter 1, verse 20 says, "In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom." In chapter 1, verse 7, we see that King Nebuchadnezzar gives Daniel and his friends new names. Again, this is one of those verses that we tend to either skim through or skip through or take lightly, but in the Jewish culture that they were from, names actually had a significant importance. So we hear the names Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, but we don't remember that these weren't actually the names that they were given. These weren't their Hebrew names. So in Daniel 1, verses 6 and 7, it says this: "Among those who were chosen were some from Judah: Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official gave them new names: to Daniel, the name Belteshazzar; to Hananiah, Shadrach; to Mishael, Meshach; and to Azariah, Abednego." The name Hananiah means God is gracious. Mishael means who is like God. Azariah means God is my helper. So by these guys sacrificing their Hebrew names, they're not just having a name change, but they're losing some of their identity, because their names had great meaning and now they're getting these new Babylonian names that don't mean much to them. In the 1800s and 1900s, there's this man, I'm going to mess up his name, but hopefully you might know and be able to correct yourself, by the name of Walter Rosenbusch. I learned about him in school. And so this guy became increasingly frustrated with the church. He lived in an area in New York City where there was a lot of poverty, there was a lot of crime and corruption, and he was involved in the church, and he just, week after week, he would attend church, and he would see people coming together and praising the Lord, but then he would leave the church walls, and he would go outside, and he would continue to see how corrupt everything was, and the church didn't do anything about it. So he eventually became so frustrated that he decided he wanted to do something about it. And flash forward a few centuries, and we read about him in church history textbooks, and he's one of kind of the central figures of what we term the social gospel movement. So this movement resulted in a lot of positives within the church and society, and many of them actually, they've affected what we do today, and they kind of influenced what church looks like today. However, even though they did have many positive effects, there are still there are some who became so passionate about the social, but then they forgot about the gospel. So they got so passionate about all these social injustices, but then they forgot that Jesus was kind of the reason that we do all these things. So I've heard some Christians in some circles say that this is an example of the slippery slope. So you get into, you get involved in something that could be considered controversial, and eventually you walk that line and you fall down the slippery slope. I think we could say the same about Daniel and his friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They kind of walked along this slippery slope. They went into this land where it wasn't a Jewish land, or we might say that it wasn't like a Christian or a God-honoring land. And so they were walking this slippery slope, but in the end, as we read later on towards the end of chapter 10, even though they're on this slippery slope, they eventually draw this firm line in the ground, and they refuse to bow down and to worship the statue. Centuries later, we see the church enter into some of the darkest places in society. And while it resulted in much good, there are some people who have fallen down this quote-unquote slippery slope. So then the question that I've been wrestling with and that many of us wrestle with is how far is too far? How do we know where to draw that line? What is idol worship? Or when are we actually bending but not breaking this line? A few years ago, again, I'm going to come back to the subject of judgment because I have a few controversial stories in this message. A few years ago, I had a friend, it was her birthday, and she invited a few of us to go to the Dome. So I don't know if you guys know what the Dome is. If you do, shame on you. So the Dome is, it has a reputation as, it's a nightclub in Halifax with an interesting reputation, I'll say that. So again, this wasn't something I was interested in. But one of my other friends that was invited, he wanted to go, and I didn't quite understand because he was a solid kind of Christian guy. So he persuaded me to go. And I was just kind of going along. I didn't really think much about the situation, but I think at this point in time he has a very deep faith, and he could see something deeper into the situation that maybe I couldn't see. I wasn't going to the Dome in hopes of evangelizing everyone in this nightclub, and I don't think that was necessarily what he was trying to do either, but he could see something that maybe I couldn't see. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, so they lived in this religious bubble, Israel, and they didn't have a plan of leaving. However, they ended up in this foreign land in these practices that maybe we can compare a bit to the Dome. They were in this situation where things just were not, they were outside of their religious bubble. And I'm sure that when Nebuchadnezzar first called them, they had a lot of thoughts running through their mind. I'm sure they didn't just up and leave. They're humans just like us, so I'm sure they had many thoughts. Like, how do you greet each other in this culture? I know for me, whenever I enter a new culture, one of my first thoughts is, what am I going to eat? What kind of food do they eat here? But what they didn't conclude was that going to Babylon would result in them disobeying God. They still up and they still left. And I think the reason for that is because the whole time, no matter on their situation or where they were at, they knew who they were supposed to worship. They knew their God. They knew to obey him, and they weren't caught up in where they were and who they were around. So it's been a long time since the writing of these events. I was actually in a debate in school of when this book was written. I still can't give you a concrete answer, but I could t- tell you the sides of it, but either way, it was written a long time ago, and a lot of things have changed. But God has not changed. The covenant has changed, the way that maybe the world works and what God expects looks a little different, but God has not changed. In fact, while he was present then, in a way we could say he's even more present now. He's always been omnipresent, but as you know, when Jesus died and the veil was torn, then he made his presence available to all, and it wasn't just to a select few. So we could say that God is actually present anywhere, anytime, to anyone. So we don't have to hide from Babylon. We don't have to hide from, I'm not suggesting that we all get up and go to the dome. I probably will never be back there unless they had church at the dome one time, and that was kind of fun. But what I'm saying is we don't have to hide in our religious bubbles. We don't have to seek to stay in our Israel where everyone is fearing God. Right? Isn't that what the gospel is? Didn't Jesus go outside of that bubble, and didn't he cross those borders for the sake of making God known? He went and he interacted with some of the marginalized of society, and he didn't compromise. He didn't forget the God he worshipped and bowed down to other gods. But he was able to bring the God that he knew and that he worshipped into those places in society. So yeah, we still need to think critically about what we do. Please don't leave here and say, oh, the guy who spoke said that we should just go into all the craziest places and do whatever we want. That's not what I'm saying. But I find so often, and I say this from experience, we get so caught up in the nitty-gritty. We get so caught up in the do's and the don'ts and the this and the that, rather than get caught up in the who. Because I think that's at the heart of it. That's kind of what happened with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They were involved in all these slippery slope situations, but the whole time they knew who they worshipped. They knew their God. And I think it's the same for us. We think critically, but I don't think we have to get caught up in the nitty-gritty, but just remember that we have the God of the universe with us, and we can take him with us wherever we go. And so we don't have to stay in our religious bubble. So yeah, my conclusion is this. When we make decisions in life, would we be willing, like Shadrach, like Meshach, like Abednego, like Jesus, would we be willing to cross these lines, cross these boundaries, not so that we would compromise, but so that we could take the God that we worship to those people and to those places where he is not worshipped? Because while they did draw that line and they refused to worship other gods, and it actually says after, if we were to continue reading that Nebuchadnezzar ended up worshiping this god, and that wouldn't have happened if these people hadn't crossed those lines. And I mean, although he did, you know, he had his ups and downs along the way. But he never would have had that experience if people hadn't have crossed those lines. So yeah, let me pray.